Okay. Are you ready to begin? What?
So that you're on the slideshow? Do you know how to...
Well, the thing is I'm going to be sort of moving between them
okay.
Kind of in an arbitrary way. Yeah. So I'm revealing the infrastructure, so you have a way of reverse engineering my talk. As you know, depending on where I'm giving the talk, I might give these things in different order. But what I want to talk about here is the Converging Technologies Agenda, so what's called NBIC. Does this acronym mean... Are there people who don't know what this means? Okay. Actually, it's surprising in the United States... This is the idea of it's a way of trying to integrate the sciences to enhance the human condition, and it involves imagining that there are certain sorts of sciences that are really going to be able to contribute to this in a very direct way. And so we're talking about nanotechnology, the N, biotechnology, the B, information technology, and cognitive science. Okay, and so what I've got here in the first slide is a quote, actually, from the NSF document from 2002, which laid this out as kind of a policy agenda issue. And as you see, if the cognitive scientists can think it, the nano people can build it, the bio people can implement it, and the IT people can monitor and control it. Now, the thing here is that this agenda, We really need to take seriously the idea of enhancing human performance. What exactly does that mean? This idea, however far-fetched or futuristic it may seem on the surface, was in fact, mirrored and adopted with some modification by the European Union as well as something, and it got a somewhat different spin, where the social science element of it was highlighted more directly. But the basic idea, there are two kinds of sources for interest in this kind of idea. First, I should say that the people who were involved in it at the NSF side were Michael Rocco, who is the head of the nanotechnology division, who's a mechanical engineer by training. And there's a kind of an interest in, first of all, the general downturn in terms of student enrollment and also employment in the physical and chemical sciences, and what to do with such people in light of the end of the Cold War. And nanotechnology becomes a kind of rebranding exercise under these circumstances, right? Because in a sense, nanotechnology is kind of chemistry, but it's under this kind of new sort of vision whereby you're targeting the chemistry to sort of make people enhanced in some way. And William Sims Bainbridge, the other author of this document, is the head of social informatics at the NSF, and is by training a sociologist of religion. Okay, and in fact is one of the big promoters of the idea of cyber immortality. Okay, so we've got these two kinds of constituencies, you might say, who are very much informing what the NSF vision was. One, on the one hand, a kind of very practical one about a sort of change in the labor force and the labor market as a result of the end of the Cold War, where you got a lot of surplus of physical and chemical scientists, and of course then this kind of visionary idea that reflects new developments in recent technology with regard to information technology and how people are redefining themselves in relation to that. And so the issue of what human identity becomes is a kind of an issue that is very much paramount. Now, there's another context in which, from the U.S. side, this has been a big deal, and that is as a kind of a security, national security issue, in particular biosecurity, right? So the idea of having nanotechnology come into your bloodstream and fortifying you in various ways, right, then enables you to be immune from various kinds of attacks via anthrax. I mean, you have to remember the anthrax thing, how iconic that was in the United States, and other kinds of biosecurity threats that might happen in the future. People had kind of fortified bodies. They'd be able to withhold that. And so there's a sense in which one can think about a new way in which one might sort of re-spin physical and chemical research as part of a new defense strategy. right? Because there's the issue, you know, as was pointed out yesterday, right, the military is the primary funder of research in the United States, at the government side, even at the basic level. And so here's a new conception, you know, rather than focusing on, you know, nuclear stuff and anti-ballistic missiles and things like this, one would now shift the focus to biosecurity. And there, nano and biotechnology in particular would have some very important role to play. Okay, so that's kind of the American side of the story. Now, the European side of the story, where I would say the major philosopher who's been involved in this has been Alfred Nordman, and other people have been involved, and of course, many of us have been involved in EU initiatives relating to the ENVIC story on the European side. The European side's a little bit different. The emphasis is on social welfare and sort of promoting more productive lives. And this has a lot to do with a kind of pensions crisis, social insurance crisis, as people are living longer, and yet nevertheless, if you have a retirement age at 65, right, that means that there are going to be people living longer lives drawing pensions, and maybe we might want to have a reasonable way of raising the age of retirement so that people are paying into the system longer. Right, so you want to find some way at a systematic level of making human lives more productive. And I think that's really very much what makes the Europeans quite interested in this, given the large sort of social welfare state that exists in this part of the world. And the security issue is not so strong. And in fact, the fact that the Americans highlight the security issue is often used as a stick to beat Americans against, you know, those Americans, you know, being militaristic and so forth again. But there's an economic argument for talking in these terms at the European end. So we've got two somewhat different agendas, but nevertheless kind of feeding into this general idea that we want our science policy to enhance human beings and the human condition in some fashion. Okay. Now, the point I want to start to begin to raise here, and as I'm the British partner in one of the EU six framework projects that's involved in this issue. So the precedent for this kind of thinking, you know, so if you're saying, is this a radically new thing that's never happened before? No, the answer is no. The precedent for this comes from the early 19th century. It comes from Count Saint-Simon, who Marx demonized as a utopian socialist, and is normally known these days as the mentor of Auguste Comte, the founder of positivism. Okay, and Saint-Simon was one of these people who you might say has a kind of a initially Enlightenment sensibility, but having lived through the French Revolution, realizes kind of the problems, and also having lived through Napoleon and living during the period where Napoleon had this promise of unifying Europe, but it kind of failed at the end. But nevertheless, maybe this is a project that should be returned to in the future. So Saint-Simon wrote this book in 1815 called Towards a Reorganization of Europe. And it was in this context that he started to propose what sorts of disciplines would be necessary to have this kind of consolidated European identity, which would be able to promote human beings into this modern future. Okay, and what I'm doing here in this slide is basically showing how, in a sense, he's kind of identified the kinds of disciplines, and what's happened over the last couple of centuries is that there's been a sort of an upgrading or translation of what the disciplines are, but the functions that need to be served are similar. Okay, so cognitive science now provides a kind of, you might say, theoretical explanatory framework in the contemporary ENVIC agenda. It's the place where our understanding of human beings and how they think and what they're about comes from at the most general philosophical level. But in the 19th century, Saint-Simon was proposing social science. And I think one of the things that you're going to see about this kind of shift from the 19th to the 21st century is, as it were, in the 19th century, people were talking very much in externalist terms, organizing people, organizing the environment in a very sort of externally or observable way. But now in the 21st century, we're thinking about things in a much more intensive, internally, you know, getting inside the people, re-engineering them sort of way. But nevertheless, the goals are quite similar. So we have a shift from the social science to the cognitive science. And in the 19th century, Saint-Simon was talking very much about the need to build things like schools, hospitals, prisons, right, what we call in sociology carceral institutions, because they confine your body in terms of where it can move around, okay? And this is all done from the outside, as it were, right? We're monitoring you, we're confining your space. But now we've got nanotechnology, when in a sense we can kind of, you know, we can kind of confine the movements of your body from the inside by getting into your blood system and into your nervous system and so forth, and re-engineering that so that your movements are confined, right? So in a sense, instead of doing it from the outside, we can do it from the inside, right? That's kind of the, so instead of having carceral institutions, we can go inside through nanotechnology and re-engineer you in various ways. Okay, and of course, Saint-Simon highlighted very much the idea of scientific medicine, both at the forensic and the corrective level, that is to say, at the level of diagnosis, and at the level of cure, as a way of in fact, having this kind of upgraded sort of humanity. And I think, you know, some of you may know that well into the 19th century, there were arguments made for making medicine the fundamental social science. Right, that in a sense, the whole idea of medicine being a branch of or of biological science or applied biology, as a lot of people think of it today, this is a 20th century idea. That in fact, in the 19th century, it was kind of an open kind of story about what exactly medicine would become as it became more scientific, and not part of the traditional kind of liberal arts professions curriculum. And what Saint-Simon was talking about as the prospects for medicine. Are the things that have been realized to a large extent through biotechnology, and increasingly so, especially if you think about the way in which biotechnology enters into the pharmaceutical industries and so forth. And then the last thing that was very much part of Saint-Simon's program was the idea of vital statistics, you know, sort of a very much sophisticated version of the census, where one does keep track of things like, first of all, how productive people are, and so things like gross national product per capita, these kinds of ideas. I mean, Saint-Simon's very much influenced by the political economy of the political economists of France in the 19th century, the so-called physiocrats, right, who in a sense imagined the political economy as a literal body politic, right, in a sense where the society has a physiology, essentially, right, and so that one can monitor the vital statistics within that. And Saint-Simon is thinking very much along those lines as well, and so one wants to keep very accurate statistics on a large range of factors. And of course, with information technology, we're able to do that not only more, you know, at a more fine-grained level, but we can even do it in a way in which the people who provide the data are contributing in it in a self-selecting, relatively unobtrusive manner by participating in the processes that we can then record. Okay, so you get sort of self-surveillance going on, essentially. And so it's, an upgraded version of what Saint-Simon thought was necessary. And if you have all these things in place, right, these become the fundamental sciences on the basis of which you can sort of launch a kind of social progress, which Saint-Simon imagined would be the sort of hallmark of a reorganized Europe. That is to say, do Napoleon's project right. Okay, and so this was being proposed already in 1815, and I think it's very much part of the spirit in which this NBIC thing should be understood now, especially I think in the European context, but also in the American context. So what's the shift in focus from the 19th to the 21st centuries? Well, it's quite clear that Saint-Simon was thinking primarily in terms of institutions and professions that would have to be part of the vanguard of this kind of reorganized super-social society. But nowadays we're thinking about this much more in individual terms, whether we're talking about individuals contributing their data, as it were, to vital statistics in the country. You know, in other words, nobody has to force you to contribute the data. You're already spontaneously doing this on the internet. Right, there's that aspect to it, right? But also at the level at which we can think about potentially some kind of social planning where you can directly participate in it depending upon what kinds of treatments you decide to get for yourself and so forth. And so one can imagine a situation, we talked a little bit about this yesterday, in relation to the antenatal screening, for example, right, where there's a sense in which, you know, you can have a general sense of what the society's goals are, but you at an individual level can decide on whether a child that you know will have certain kinds of genetic properties will exist or not, and you're sort of participating in the process as a result. And you're part of this planning process, and it's part of your normal way of operating. So this idea of taking something that in the past would have been institutionalized, perhaps top-down, perhaps led by experts, now becomes something that's internalized, individualized, something becomes part of your spontaneous way in which you operate in the world. Okay, and it seems to me that there's that sort of shift. And so consequently, we have a shift from the external to the internal environment as the place where all of this action is happening. I didn't say disastrous. No, that's you're reading that into... No, we get... That's for the discussion, man. I'm trying to be neutral at this point. But what we're talking about here is this kind of, you know, as I say in the third bullet point, right, intensive interventions. So it's no longer, you know, because in the past we've thought in terms of, you know, you have this image of eugenics, for example, right, where the state has a kind of idea of what's the ideal person, and you either conform to it or not, and if you don't, right, we force something, we sterilize you, or, you know, we do something against your will, and as it were, all the negative moral aspects of this comes out through the coercive element because it's coming from the outside. Right? But that's not what's happening now, right? What's happening now is as this stuff, especially as this stuff gets talked about more, because as you know, a lot of the actual science and technology isn't really in place yet to be able to enable NBIC to happen. But of course, we're scenario mongering and making a good living out of this, right? We were talking about this yesterday. So we're softening people up to this, right? No doubt about it. So that when actually the science and technology comes along, right, people will have been so softened up, it won't seem like forcing at all. It in fact will have become part of consumer culture. It will be part of the anticipatory advertising, I mean governance of all this. So... You know, what this means is that when we actually get to the state where all of these visions are being realized, it won't seem like forcing people at all. It'll be something that you'll spontaneously do or want to have done for a little while. Okay? Because we're already doing all of this advanced planning through the advertisement of scenario mongering and coming up with programs and talking amongst ourselves and teaching our students and all the rest of it. So in a sense, we will have gotten over that big hurdle the 19th century people never got over, was the idea that, you know, if you're elite with a certain kind of idea about how society should go, the only way you can get it across is by force feeding it to people, right? The communist revolution, all the rest of it, where heads have to roll. But now we realize, no, you just give enough advance warning, give enough lead time, right, and you start trailing it, as they say in the media, right? You start, you know, so you have the commercials for the TV programs that are coming on next week, right? That's kind of what we do in STS. Right, we're the intellectual trailers. Right, and people make good money out of this, right? So that when actually we get to the point where we're able to do this, no one will kick up a fuss, right? In fact, people will wonder, why didn't it happen sooner? Okay, so this is how the world has changed from the 19th to the 21st century. It's sort of changed at the meta level. And in this respect, you know, we do learn from history, right? Because the reason why the 19th century revolutions failed and the Russian Revolution failed was because these people were just force-feeding the stuff, right? But now if you trail it long enough, you can get people to accept it. Right, and now that we have universities and educational institutions and academics operating as media mediators, right, and not just at the level of television and radio, but of course in the classroom and in seminars like this, we're trailing all this stuff. So the fact that this stuff's not going to happen now or tomorrow doesn't matter, right? We're already talking about it. I mean, in a sense, the NBIC people have won. Right? They've already won. We're talking about this. This is important. Okay? And as long as... And of course, what happens then is people want to get involved. There's a kind of involvement in the process that's already happening. And then this is the business about more extensive data gathering in the sense that we no longer... People are quite voluntarily giving up their data in various ways. Right? So, for example... you know, at the crass end of it, the national identity cards, which will turn into genetic barcodes in the next 10 or 15 years, perhaps, in Europe, right, there's that aspect. But of course, you know, people willing to be scanned and so forth to be able to go through barriers so they can take planes, right? And also, there are many other ways where, we're, in fact, data is just being spontaneously collected about people. And that will enable this kind of process to move forward as well. Okay, and we're all just voluntarily contributing to it. So there's a sense in which, however, futuristic you may think of this kind of NBIC agenda of enhancing human beings and moving them to some sort of direction, in fact, the mechanisms are already in place to enable this kind of thing to happen, even if the actual things that would enable you to scale up to humanity 2.0 isn't quite there. Nevertheless, the preparation is already being laid, and we are the people providing it. Right? We are the vanguard for this. No doubt about it. Okay, so then the question arises as to what exactly do we mean when we talk about this enhancement? And in a sense, this is kind of what I want to... How much time do I have, by the way, so I don't overrun?
If you want to leave some time for discussion...
Sure, I do.
Yeah, well, a few minutes.
A few minutes, come on. I mean, can you give me 10 minutes? 10 minutes, maybe?
Steve, you have to 1:45.
Okay.
And that clock is 5 minutes fast.
Okay. Because what I want to do here... What?
Including discussion.
Yeah, what?
If he says
11,
that's including this.
Oh, okay. Well, let me, and I can leave the slides for people who want to see. Let me just sort this out, and I'm going to put, and I don't know what I'm doing with that. What is it that you have to do to actually get the thing on the whole screen? Because this is the last slide.
Slideshow
there. But, dude, don't want to cause any trouble here. Because this is the thing, in a sense, what do these enhancements, what kind of futures are we talking about, normative futures for humanity, that comes from this converging technologies agenda? The one that we've been talking about so far, and I've been sort of presupposing, is what strictly speaking could be called enhancement, where basically what you're trying to do is to take what you normally imagine as ordinary human productive lives, but extending it a bit longer. Right? So you're not qualitatively trying to transform human beings or anything, but you're just like, if you've worked in a job, rather than, degrading at age 65, you degrade at 70 or 75. Okay? So it's a fairly kind of a quantitative increase along dimensions we already recognize. But there are other more ambitious notions that are also attached onto this, and of course are, I think, of very important philosophical significance. And the first one is prolonging life. Okay, with the idea of immortality as some sort of regulative ideal of what we should be aiming for. And of course, it is possible, at least with mice and other lower organisms, to reverse age-related disintegration. And the idea is that maybe we should be putting a lot of research into that so that people can actually just live longer. And that's seen as a sort of desirable goal in itself. Okay? It seems to me that this idea, while often enhancement people talk about this, from a conceptual standpoint, I want to keep these two ideas distinct, because one can talk about, as it were, having more productive, normal lives that get you, another 5 or another 10 years and so forth. But we're not talking about necessarily in that context extending people's lives indefinitely. Because if that itself is seen as a goal, then the whole way in which we organize human society starts to be called into question. Okay, so for example, the value of reproduction, the role of memory. I mean, there are a lot of issues that start to sort of get flagged up once we talk about prolongation as a goal. Okay, so, but nevertheless, there are people talking this way as well, and they have sort of piggybacked on the enhancement agenda. And we've got a guy in Britain, for example, Aubrey de Grey, at Cambridge University, who's really kind of devoting his life to immortalism, okay, as some kind of regulative ideal. And there are a lot of, well-to-do people in Silicon Valley who back all of his research and so forth. But the point I just want to make is this is another issue to add on top of enhancing. It isn't necessarily a logical consequence of enhancing, okay? Then the other, which I mentioned here, transcending the human condition. Now this one, what I mean here is kind of when Julian Huxley coined the word transhumanism, which is often the context in which we discuss these sorts of prospects, right? What he had in mind was the idea of human beings taking control of natural selection so that in a sense it gets subsumed under artificial selection. right? So in other words, once we understand, you know, and he's already proposing this in the 1920s, and of course, by the time we get to the DNA revolution and all the rest of it, we start to get a little closer to this possibility, right? It's kind of a sense in which, okay, the more and more you know about the genetic makeup of humanity, the more you now are in a position to exert responsibility over what the future makeup of people are going to be. And it becomes a form of artificial selection, just like we already use in agriculture. Huxley was very keen in his lifetime to separate this view out from any kind of racism of the sort that the Nazis were practicing under eugenics. Okay, so you may know that the UN document on race that came out in 1950 he was the main author of this, and he was making a very important point about the promotion of human rights and humanity and everything, where race is not part of what distinguishes people. But that didn't get rid of his interest in eugenics, right? It was just rather that the eugenics would be much more finely grained, right? In the sense that you would think about what it is, what kind of society we want to live in, and the problem with race is backward looking. Right, race is entirely based on where people came from. Whereas, in fact, if we're talking about the future, right, we're talking about what kind of people we want to be. And Huxley wanted to keep those two questions quite different. And the problem with the Nazis was that they didn't keep the questions different. Right, they based the future kind of on the past. And then this is really not on in, you know, a modern liberal scientific society. Okay. So this is the kind of idea, and of course there are people who are talking this way as well, about this idea of transcending the transhumanist thing where we actually manipulate the genome in a very fundamental way, but not necessarily with a racist agenda, but with the categories that are more relevant to the lives we lead now. Now then there's the issue of translating what's valuable to humans, and things then start to get a little interesting, because what we're talking about here is the idea that, what is it exactly that's valuable about being a human being? And does it require that we have the human bodies we currently do? Okay, and this is where the issue of what does, projecting your identity into the future, what is it about yourself that you would like to survive? Right? Because, see, the interesting thing about immortalism, if you look at the prolonged side, is immortalism presupposes that you want the human body to survive indefinitely, and so we're going to be reversing the age-related illnesses and things like that. But, of course, there's a long tradition, certainly in Western culture, where what distinguishes us most as human beings is really rather contingent on the animal body we've got, but has to do with more spiritual, intellectual, rational kinds of things, which in principle might be embodied in more durable form, in more kind of, in more powerful forms, right? And indeed, the enthusiasm that is associated with, first of all, the upgrading of consciousness into machines. The fact that, regardless of whether it can be done, the fact that people like this idea, right, and the fact that people are throwing money at this idea is a very interesting thing, right? And people like Ray Kurzweil, right, the age of spiritual machines, the singularity is near. This whole idea that, this is where we're moving toward, this is his idea of evolution. His idea of evolution isn't, manipulating a few genes to get us to a kind of, more enhanced version of what we were as Homo sapiens. No, for him, it's the move out of the carbon-based existence into a silicon-based existence. Right, and insofar as there is an intellectual, rational, spiritual life, right, that it should be possible to make that kind of change in matter. Right, and this is obviously a very old, ancient kind of desire. Right, one of the ways in which I think you see this being manifested is in terms of the second self phenomena, where people become more strongly identified with the identities they have in cyberspace. In fact, they spend all their time on it. So if you want to take some kind of metric of what it is that people find meaningful in their lives, what do they spend time doing? Okay? And so even people who now live carbon-based existences as ordinary Homo sapiens, right, they're spending most of their time in cyberspace and investing all of their energies and their creativity and in these kind of second self phenomena. That already gives you a sense of the market for this kind of idea, regardless of whether the technology is available. Okay? again, I'm being neutral in the presentation of this, but the point is that that is another way of thinking about what the post-human future is like, is actually moving into that dimension. And that's why people like Kurzweil have an enormous constituency. Now, I want to bring up two more at the end. One is to incorporate. This is one that I think is quite interesting and has an interesting kind of history that really hasn't been told. I mentioned this, the Latin word universitas, right, which is from where we get our word university and so forth. And this was an innovation in Roman law in the Middle Ages, whereby your identity is not in terms of your family origin, neither is it in terms of particular temporary projects that you're involved in, but rather it's in terms of these long-term self-sustaining projects in which you acquire a new identity. So, for example, when you become a member of a religious order, when you become a citizen of a town, right, when you become a part of a university, a member of a discipline, or a member of a guild, what happens is that you, as it were, you replace your earlier identity, which was primarily in terms of your family, with this new identity that you managed to get by virtue of passing examinations and some other kind of artificial mechanism, where you show yourself to be adept at being able to reproduce this artificial entity, the corporation, as we call it in English, right? I mean, the universitas is the Latin for corporation. And so you adopt a corporate identity. So when you become a bureaucrat, right, and it's no longer your individual personal identity that matters, but your ability to promote this kind of corporate entity. And most of the kinds of social entities that are of concern to social science, especially sociology, that we talk about modern society, are of this kind, where people, in a sense, somehow reconfigure their identity. So they're no longer just products of their families, but they are products of this sort of larger artificial entity that they somehow have contracted into.
Nationalism.
Right, nationalism, right, all these things. Yeah, but the point is it's a very continuous process. But of course, one might think about this in much more material terms, right, in a sense in which we become incorporated into the environment. Right, not just in the sense of adopting a new spiritual identity, which is what nationalism and being religion, being member of a religion and so forth is about, but we actually embed ourselves in the environment, and as it were, our identity includes our environment. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this term. You're probably familiar with Richard Dawkins' term, the extended phenotype. I mean, part of the idea here being that organisms, right, as part of their survival mechanism, reconfigure their environments in ways that enable them to reproduce. And as it were, the environment becomes part of what's selected alongside of the organism itself. So they're sort of selected together, right? The organism and the environment are selected together. And so it becomes one unit, as it were, from a natural selection standpoint. Okay? But also there's this idea of the supersized mind. I don't know if people have run across this. Andy Clark, a lot of these kind of cognitive science people who are taking quite seriously the role that artifacts play in defining identity. You know, because normally, I mean, we operate typically on an assumption that the stuff that's outside our world are just extensions of our mind or representations of our mind in some sort of way. But what if these things are actually constitutive of our identity in a very material, ontological way? Right, in a sense, so when people say, I can't live without my iPod, right, I can't live without my computer, I feel like I've lost a limb, someone even said this here at some point to me, right, I mean, if one takes that literally, right, this is kind of what I mean when I talk about a new sense of incorporation, where in a sense the identity is being extended not to the social entity, but it's being extended to part of the material environment, and as it were, you have a vested interest in wanting to maintain that as much as you would want to maintain your normal carbon-based self. Okay? And there are people like that, and we're now developing philosophies of mind. I mean, 2-3 weeks ago, there was a review of this book, The Supersized Mind, by Andy Clark, by Jerry Fodor, who's, of course, very old-fashioned in this regard and believes that, the mind is inside the head and, all that Cartesian stuff, right? And he was very critical of this supersized mind as, a product of woolly thinking and fashionableness, which that when he says stuff like that, there's a grain of truth to what they're talking about. No. So seriously, I do think this is something, in a way, we need to be thinking about, because, again, it's part of this issue of with whom do you identify? With what are you, you know, when you talk about the future of humanity, even if you don't think you yourself will be participating in it, what is it about yourself that you value and in other people that you want to see pushed forward into the future? I mean, as you know, there is a certain part of ethics that's very much concerned with future generations, right? Derek Parfit and that whole tradition there. And I think what we're entering into here with the Converging Technologies agenda is a kind of open-endedness with regard to projectability of the human, right? What exactly is it that you want to see carried forward into the future about humanity that you would feel satisfied with, okay? And it might not be just some kind of smarter version of what you are now. It might be some much more complex, sophisticated kind of thing, and I'm pointing out what the possibilities might be. Now, finally, we've got the business of testing, because one thing that doesn't get emphasized very much, but I think is in fact happening, is the degree to which governments should be involved in encouraging people to take experiments with their lives on these matters. Right? I mean, because remember, we live in a neoliberal world, and unless we're going to move to socialism tomorrow, the bottom line is going to be that people are, in fact, going to be experimenting with this stuff, and we might want to encourage them to do this, given that we don't know what all the alternative futures are going to bear, but we want to know about the consequences of it. Okay? So this is where I say risk-taking protected by social insurance. In other words, I would like, I mean, I'm just speaking for myself here, It would be good for governments to actually encourage people to move into these kind of alternative projections of humanity in whatever they want, whatever ways they want, but that there be some kind of social insurance for this in case things go disastrously wrong. Okay, so in other words, to remove as much of the fear factor as possible from this, and incorporate this into a welfare policy. And I realize this is a very controversial thing, and one would have to think about the parameters exactly, but already these kinds of things are happening. And it seems to me it would be good if governments and state, if the European Union, whatever, actually encouraged this, but also monitored what was happening. And the only way you're going to be able to do that is if people feel there's some kind of protection at a state level, if they end up doing something disastrously wrong with themselves, if they, you know, test some new drug, you know, if they get their genes manipulated in some way to have some kind of disastrous thing that they didn't want, that there be some protection. But I think a lot of this is going to turn out to be very experimental in terms of which way we go in the future. And the Converging Technologies agenda, in a way, is opening ourselves to this. And we're contributing to this process, like it or not, by talking about it so much, that in a sense we're going to need policies that will protect people when they do decide to experiment and move in these different directions. And with that, I will close there. Okay. Yeah.
Some grist for your mill. I was just playing.
My John Stewart mill? No.
No, not that one.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that one.
Yeah, that one.
So your Brit's presentation on the broader impact criteria,
yeah,
and affectionately known as BIC, so just bracket and end in advance.
There you go.
But then the counter side to that is to put all of this back on you and say, what form of nanosecurity can you offer other than the individual therapy, which then drives the softening up, right? The STSer gets involved, studies this, becomes worried, studies it more, becomes more worried, studies it more, and starts to sort of, you know, make peace with it. Meanwhile, that individual effect is perhaps therapeutic for the individual, but, you know, it's pointing to a social phenomenon.
Yeah, but see, the thing is, we're talking about it, and some of us here who aren't doing the frontline research on this will be teaching it to other people. I mean, it seems to me these ideas are, I mean, this is very...
Yes, no, I'm serious about, you know, what is the nanosecurity?
Well, what do you mean exactly? That we might be saying something disastrously wrong and not protecting against it?
What are the modes of protection?
What are the modes of protection? Well, see, maybe I'm just a little too postmodern at this point about this. And maybe this is where we will start to have some disagreements with our Aristotelian friends. I do think that one of the things that defines us as human beings is that we are open, and that we should be protecting against you know, very bad, disastrous consequences at the level of it makes it impossible for you to live a life that you'd been accustomed to in the past and so forth. But in terms of what kinds of prospects we should be able to live with as a culture, as a whole, I'm kind of open-minded about that. Okay, so I'm not going to have a priori limits necessarily on this. I mean, I'm...
Well, it can be procedural.
Yeah, yeah, no, no, I guess this is where I would say the state ought to be more actively involved, because I think one of the things that's very disappointing here is that states very often have a kind of... very black or white attitude, right? So in the United States, you stop stem cell research, right? And that's wrong. Yeah, yeah, and it goes somewhere else, right? You know, or you have a completely free market environment where people just sort of do what they want. They privately absorb the consequences, which I think is a mistake as well. And what you want to do is you want to have some kind of public involvement. You know, and that's where the state comes in as the representative of the public to make what people are doing public, to people to see the consequences visibly, and for it not to be something that people are afraid of. That in fact, it's something that we can very openly discuss and make part of the normal public conversation.
So you want to rationalize?
You now also take perhaps seriously this futuristic agenda.
Yes, I do take it seriously.
Yeah. I remember when this NSF report came out, it immediately hit a nerve in our department where I was in Houston. And, you know, they asked us, you know, what shall we do with it? So our immediate reaction was just one sentence. We need an alternative research agenda.
Sure.
So, and that does not mean that it goes in the direction of a la Rocco.
No, that's right.
So, and this is also what's subsequently happened. I mean, this is also, if one wants to try to link yourself to impact assessment, because it's not immediately clear from your talk how this relates to the workshop.
Well, the good life part is what I'm really tapping into here, because we're talking about the future of the good life.
And also this, which means alternative research agendas. So it's not only this, let's say, techno-optimistic, futuristic.
It's not lazy. No, this is why I want the state involved. Okay, I want people like you involved, but you got to start taking it seriously. That's the point.
Oh, if we take it seriously in developing alternative research agendas, and this is actually what happened. I mean, we had, I was also in the group with this Alfred. I think it was actually our first initial reaction to the whole event, which then subsequently, through some other steps, translated in alternative research agendas within our projects. I have a couple of them actually, and you know, we have monitoring programs. What we have a monitoring program. What's actually the technological advance in these areas? Now, if I read those reports, calm down the worried Aristotelians, because the technical advance at the moment is rather minimal.
You can't just think in those terms. That's the thing.
Well, I mean, this is what justifies us. We have to monitor, so this is what we do. What otherwise, I mean, this is just, I don't see any other action than that you would, I mean, yes, also relating to our teams. I mean, it's not on the level of research proposals, it's more on the level of how you develop other research programs.
Yeah, but see, one of the things that we're doing as STS people now, and this relates to to your talk yesterday, is that we are shifting the values already, right? In a sense, we are softening people up to this. All the time we talk about the human versus non-human doesn't matter. You know, I mean, all of these things that we do a lot in STS really are softening people up to these possibilities, so that when someone actually does make an innovation that is relevant to this, people will be able to understand it immediately and resonate with it.
Well, how can you say we, Steve?
What?
You said we STS people.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't that somewhat imperialistic? There are other STS people who don't do that.
No, but the point is, I, for better or worse, the sort of actor network perspective with this sort of ontological leveling idea is the dominant perspective in STS, at least as the brand name of STS. Right, insofar as it's distinctive from anything else, it's associated with that. I think nowadays, you know, a la Latour and everything, for better or worse.
Well, I mean, this is a discussion with René, because I myself would go for alternative research agendas, deflating the whole MBIC stuff, and I've developed, in a sense, a number of ways to do that. And Alfred Berkman is doing similar things, and we have this, he will be doing something in Nature Nanotechnology about the wrong gap. Now, ethics is leaping ahead, and your sort of discussion of human enhancement and convergence is also leaping ahead.
Yes.
And that's a big risk. And I think you people here in the room actually see that there is a risk in what you're doing.
Yes.
Exactly in the way that you lay out for us yourself, that you're sort of making people accept whatever will be coming out of that, say, converging technology agenda.
Well,
other people do different things.
I understand. Yes. I understand that, but I mean, I don't know. It just seems to me that these are things that are going to become more and more prominent as time goes on. And we're actually, in our theorizing in STS, we're already contributing to this. I mean, in fact, if STS has any kind of long-term significance, let's say from a standpoint of a historian 2 centuries from now, it'll be this. It'll be this stuff.
Well, but ahead, because a lot of these things you're mentioning are already taking place. But when I think of concrete examples, for example, a nanotechnology example, that you have a chip in your brain that helps Parkinson patients to move at the same time to be less depressed and to have longer lives, more healthy. And so I can imagine with such a kind of example that, it seems like there's some kind of social coercion going on in forcing people to live longer and be more productive or something. But if you look at it from a more personal perspective of a Parkinson patient, this can actually mean flourishing for a longer time.
No.
And so what I was wondering during your talk is, what would your idea then be of human dignity that could be directive in these decisions about what kind of research?
Okay. Yeah.
And what kinds would not be?
I'll give you a sense of a kind of criterion I've been toying with, because I've been writing about this in many different contexts, because one context in which I've been talking about this stuff to people has been in a theological context, okay? Right? And you can easily see, I think, if you think about it, that there's a lot of theological backdrop to all this. And I guess, first of all, we have to start taking, when we talk about being human, okay, and what it means to be human. What is it that we're identifying with from the actual past of humanity? Right? And so we talk about civilization and the things that, the achievements, the things that separate us from animals. And so let's, as it were, not be Darwinian about this for a moment and assume that we're just sort of a slight difference from other animals. But what distinguishes us as humans in a very strong way? And then the issue becomes whether the people who were responsible for doing those things would identify future versions of us as a natural succession. That's something I'm working with at the moment as criterion, right? Because in a sense, our notion of what it is to be a human is very historically grounded in very specific kinds of ways, and we have certain kinds of ideas in mind that distinguish us from animals, and it has to do with what we regard as achievements of our culture and civilization. And these things can be very much contested, but it seems to me that's ultimately what we're relying on. Something of that sort.
So at what point does it become a category mistake to refer to someone like us as human?
Well, yeah, I mean, the point is that if we were to... since all you people seem to love Aristotle so much, if Aristotle were brought here today and was totally appalled by what we're talking about and who we are, not even when we're talking about my, I'm sure he'd be appalled by me, but the point is, but that he'd be appalled by Carl and by you and all you other would-be Aristotelians, right? That would be pretty significant, it seems to me. You see what I mean? This is the kind of thing. I don't know if you, some of you who read the History of Science journal ISIS, in the September issue, there was something on the counterfactuals and the history of science. And I have an article in there about the revival of normative history of science and what that might mean. And it's about this issue exactly, namely in terms of who we are, you know, how do we identify some kind of, you know, how can we use, to what extent can the past be used to legitimate what we are now, right? And with regard to the category of human, right, that's obviously a situation where we're relying on the past, right, in terms of legitimating what we are. And then the question becomes, okay, pull people out from the past, do time travel to now, and what would they make of us? Right? And I think, you know, as especially, you know, as philosophers, I think we can be quite sophisticated about this kind of analysis. You know, what would they accept, what would they not accept? In other words, have them come here and have them judge us. Because it's very easy for us to appropriate various ideas of theirs that happen to be nice for our purposes. But the question is, supposing they came over here, what would they accept, what would they reject? And see, insofar as our notions of humanity are so historically based on these exemplary figures, that criteria should matter.
Okay, but I think Aristotle doesn't have to be excluded from the history.
No, but the point is that Aristotle could be somebody brought in. Yeah.
Right.
We actually can... our colleague here has been very patient. You,
yeah.
The Australian guy.
Yeah, I'm not an Aristotelian.
No, yeah.
I was just wondering. You were talking about the good life and futures and so on. Now, if we stay more or less as we are, or if I stay more or less as I am, I know what more or less what a good life is for me. Right, given the sort of creature that I am, I can have the same sort of, I can project this into the future. Now, you know, if people are much like me, even if they've got, you know, they're different in various ways, as long as they're more or less the same, I've got a pretty good idea of the sorts of things that they'll like and so on. They won't like it if they get kicked, and they will like it if they get a good meal, that sort of thing. But if we go, I mean, if my brain gets downloaded on the computer or, you know, we get some sort of future like that, I've got no idea anymore at all what to say about what a good life would be or, you know, what I'd want. I mean, I don't really want to sit on a desk in a machine for eternity. I think I'd quite happily die.
You don't know?
I don't know.
No, but...
we don't know. I mean, we just don't know what to say anymore, I think.
No,
the
but
the notion of a good life, I think...
Look, but I do think it's very telling the amount of people who spend time in front of a computer and get involved in things like Second Self. I mean, the only thing I'm trying to bring across in the talk here is that there are diverse ways of projecting what the human is into the future, and people will stress different things. And it seems to me that there is a big policy question about what to make of that, right? Because if there are a lot of people who spend most of their time in front of a computer and get the Second Self thing, right, and that's really where all their efforts are, right, that's an important sociological point, right, about what people have become. It doesn't cover everyone, right, but nevertheless it's something we have to sort of think about and what the significance of that is. So, you know, I take your point that people will be different, but there is an emerging social problem here in terms of how people are projecting their humanity, because there are, as it were, through technology, there are more ways of doing it than ever before, it seems to me. And the management of that, you know, as part of kind of social policy, is going to become very difficult in the future. That's.
Excuse me. There is a practical problem, because people have to get out of their rooms, clear their rooms before 11. So we have to take a short break now.
Okay.
And we can continue with discussion afterwards. So let's take 10 minutes. There's coffee outside.
Okay.
And
okay. Okay.